Welcome to Diffusion, the National Science Radio Show. I'm Jackie Hayes, and on this edition, we're going to investigate how the common cold could save us all. And if you always thought your brother was a chimpanzee, stay tuned for some more recent discoveries. But up first, here's the news with Matthew Clark.
Controversial Korean scientist Professor Hwang Hoo-suk has finally had one of his cloned animals scientifically verified as being a real clone. Professor Hwang managed to clone an Afghan hound and has called the identical offspring Snuppy, which is short for Seoul National University Puppy. Professor Hwang's claims that he cloned a dog have been under intense investigation for over 7 months, but were verified in the latest edition of the journal Nature. Dogs are regarded as one of the hardest animals to clone because of the difficulty in retrieving mature eggs from the female. Hwang's team overcame this problem using a new technique to harvest the eggs, which involves flushing out the oviduct after they have matured. Professor Hwang was, of course, disgraced in 2004 for fabricating results in a paper published in the journal Science involving the production of a stem cell from a cloned human embryo. In golfing news, the Russians are planning to break the world record for the longest drive in history. Sponsored by the Canadian golf club manufacturer Element 21, cosmonaut Pavel Vinogradov plans to hit a golf ball off the side of the International Space Station with a gold-plated 6-iron. The first person to hit a golf ball in space was Alan Shepard in 1971, who claims his 2 tee shots from the surface of the moon went for miles and miles. Since there will be zero friction and very little gravity to slow it down, it's estimated that the ball will travel for approximately 3.36 billion kilometres before re-entering Earth's atmosphere. The ball will even be fitted with a tiny radio transmitter, so envious golf enthusiasts will be able to track how far it's travelled over a website. The problem with this exercise, however, is that should the ball be mishit by the cosmonaut in his extremely bulky spacesuit, there is the possibility of the ball landing in the same orbital plane as the space station and causing some major damage. In an update on global warming, researchers from the University of Colorado have announced in the journal Science that one of the Antarctic ice sheets has been losing 152 cubic kilometres a year. Here at Diffusion, we worked out that's about 608,000 eskies full, not including beer. Most of this loss is coming from the West Antarctic ice sheet and was worked out using satellites that measure the mass of the Earth. The loss of so much of the ice sheet is contributing to 4 millimetres a year to the global rise in sea levels. A total melt of this ice sheet would see ocean levels rise 6 metres and the destruction of many low-lying Pacific nations. These results are a contradiction to earlier assessments that Antarctic ice would actually grow due to increased rainfall caused by global warming. When asked how it was able to lose so much weight, it said all it took was the right diet, a little exercise, and the US and Australia's failure to sign the Kyoto Protocol. And lastly, for all you Tom Clancy techno-thriller junkies, just when you thought you couldn't make nuclear submarines any deadlier, the United States Navy have found yet another application for their Ohio-class subs. After saying goodbye to the Cold War and the necessity to keep their launch tubes brimming with multi-megaton nuclear missiles, they started to scratch their heads over what to do with all this spare real estate. After all, the missile tubes on one of these subs has around the same volume as 12 semi-trailers. So the good people at Lockheed Martin developed the Cormorant, an underwater-launched and incredibly underwater-recovered unmanned aircraft designed to spy on or destroy targets near the coast. Military designers have had their eye on something like this for a fair while, but it took Lockheed Martin's development team, otherwise known as the Skunk Works, to figure out how to launch a plane out of a sub's missile tube. The two major challenges confronting the team were how to overcome the water pressure at the proposed launch depth of 50 metres while not making the plane too heavy, and at the same time dealing with the small width of the tubes. To do this, they had to compromise and ended up with a 4-ton aircraft that is delivered to the surface by a type of crane and takes off with the assistance of a rocket. To further combat the ocean's pressure while launching, the hull of the craft is made of titanium, and every empty space not taken up with weapons or spy equipment is packed with foam to resist the inward pressure. After the plane has completed its mission, it returns to a predetermined spot, sinks to a predetermined depth, and is recovered by the same crane that launched it.
You are listening to Diffusion. Now, for all of you out there who are paranoid about that person sitting next to you on the train who is sniffing, or that person over there who just sneezed without covering their nose, you can rest assured that they're actually saving the world. Chris Stewart reports.
You'll have to excuse me if for the next few minutes I sound as if I'm speaking to you from underneath a pile of pillows. The mucous membranes in my nose are inflamed and have become overactive, so my head's feeling a bit full. There's a pressure behind my eyes and forehead, thanks to the build-up of fluid in the sinus passages that wind up through my skull. My throat is sore as well, as the membranes down there are also inflamed, making talking more difficult. Why all the membranic fuss? A tiny football-shaped nasty called a rhinovirus is reproducing in the warm, moist environment of my nasal cavity. It's invading my cells, and they're causing my immune system to kick into high gear. In an effort to fight the rhinovirus invasion, my body's front line of defense is pumping blood to the site of the attack, making my head feel hot and bothered, sapping energy resources, making me feel tired and heavy, and releasing more mucus than normal. In short, I've got a cold. Which is crazy, because it was 31 degrees outside today here in Sydney. Seems a cold is poorly named because, contrary to a still widely held belief, you can't catch cold from being cold. Surprising how many people still think that. Oh, don't get too chilly, they say. You'll catch a cold. Bah. The truth is, according to cold researchers in the US, people tend to get colds in winter because that's when you spend more time indoors, clustered around the heater, breathing on each other. The virus can last as long as 3 hours on your skin, or objects like doorknobs and telephones. So in winter, you've just got a greater chance of picking up the virus from someone else, that's all. If you'd stayed outside in the cold, you'd probably be fine. Me, I probably got my cold from my baby daughter, who probably got it from her daycare centre. All those little kitties playing together, crawling over one another. It's just a big petri dish, really. You sometimes hear people moaning, "We can put people on the moon, but we can't even cure the common cold." And fair enough, I mean, the moon landing was tricky. The cold should be easy, right? Trouble is, the cold-causing rhinovirus isn't a thing, it's a class of things. There are more kinds of cold virus than you can shake a stick at. Back in 1999, the papers heralded a cure for the cold. Scientists had found a process to stop one of the rhinoviruses dead, which is great, except A, it only worked in the test tube, and B, it only worked on one of the viruses, leaving, countless others to wreak snuffly havoc on the noses of the world. Some folks put their faith in zinc lozenges to keep the colds at bay. Others swear by the herb echinacea. Still others reckon big doses of vitamin C are the go in the fight on the common cold. Each of these treatments have been studied in detail, and the news is, well, mixed at best. Currently, there's little evidence that echinacea does much at all to prevent a cold, and a trial of 150 patients in 2005 showed no reduction in symptoms for the echinacea snaffling group once the virus had taken hold. Vitamin C doesn't prevent colds either, according to the research, and the jury is out whether it decreases symptoms by a small amount, maybe a day. Zinc, though, might have an effect. Taken at the early onset of a cold, zinc lozenges seem to reduce the symptoms by as much as a few days. Wish I'd read that a couple of days ago. But the big cold news is that a type of cold-causing virus called an adenovirus might help us in preventing flu pandemics, including the biggest threat of the day, the avian flu virus. In February this year, researchers in the States reported that they had used adenovirus in a way to vaccinate mice against a strain of the H5N1 flu virus, the one you've heard a lot about in the news lately. They took a cold virus, altered it so that it couldn't replicate, and bolted some bits of the flu virus onto it in a way that makes the immune system go into battle mode. Importantly, the technique worked against more than one strain of H5N1, which means it might be able to protect against virus mutations from one season to the next. So perhaps suffering another cold isn't so bad. At least I'm producing lots of new viruses to help the fight against avian bird flu. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm off to feel sorry for myself, drink a cup of hot lemon and honey, and collapse in a heap for a bit.
Never let it be said that Chris doesn't suffer for his art. Chris Stewart there on the latest in cold research.
She answered our ad wanted. We had a vacancy. We didn't know what was in store, but we were soon to see. She plays records of the foreskins at any given hour. She turns on the hot water tap while I'm in the shower. And at night the house is quiet, you might wonder why. But Punk's not dead, she's just gone to bed. Punk's not dead, she's just gone to bed. Damn about the friends of mine she'll scare. Some people just can't see past studs of bleach blonde spiky hair. I say A for ABBA, she says A for anarchy. In the morning she says never mind, the volunteer's your cup of tea. At night the house is quiet, you might wonder why. But Punk's not dead, she's just gone to bed. Punk's not dead, she's just gone to bed. Pass her in the kitchen, she's got a long neck in her hand. She's playing dictaphone recording of her band. The drummer has been playing for nearly 7 hours, but he hits him with such passion it makes other drummers cower. When the night has come, all safety pins must come undone. And if the house is quiet, well that's because Punk's retired for the night. If the house is quiet, well, Punk's retired for the night. Yeah, she's retired for the night. If the house is quiet, well, that's because tonight. It's one little punk rock girl.
That was Punk's Not Dead by Darren Hanlon. I'm Jackie Hayes, and you are currently listening to Diffusion. Now, we're all pretty comfortable with the idea that it's our genes that make us who we are and make us what we look like. And even more recently, since the big genome project, we've become aware of the fact that it's not necessarily the number of genes in the sequence, but it's the way that they all operate together that make us who we are. And even slight changes in gene regulation can have enormous repercussions on what you look like and your behaviour sometimes. And I think we're also all aware of the fact that our most closest relatives are the chimpanzees, the bonobos, the orangutan, the big primate family.
Some closer than other.
If you're hairy, you know, that's proof that we're all close to the orangutan. But some researchers from the University of Chicago have recently looked at the expression of 1,056 genes in the liver taken from four different primates, the man, orangutan, chimpanzee, and the rhesus macaque monkey. So 60% of the genes they looked at, so 60% of 1,056, there's some math for you to do while you're driving, were pretty much involved in some basic cellular processes, and these basic cellular processes have remained unchanged in the expression patterns between the four primates that they looked at. However, the ones that were different was the group of genes that are responsible for the transcription factors, so the genes that control the expressions of the other genes, the 60 genes that hadn't changed. Now, if we consider chimpanzees and hominids, we're the hominids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They broke off about 5 million years ago. So 5 million years ago, we were all running around doing the same thing, and now we're not. But in this 5 million year period, the transcription factor genes among humans are four times likelier to have changed expression patterns than the genes they regulate. So only in men, men and women, let's not get confused there, only in humans have these transcription factor genes changed by four times as much as the other three, which has led everyone to ask, why is it that humans are so different from these guys?
Okay, so can we wind back a little bit here? What we're saying is that us, human being type people, and our closest chimp and bonobo and whatever relatives, very, very similar. But what's different is the way our genes are being expressed.
Right. In the liver.
In the liver.
1,056 genes from the liver.
Okay.
But so it's not the actual genes that are changing, but the way all of those genes are being regulated.
Right.
So does anyone want to have a guess as to why?
Oh, is Porter throwing that one out on the table?
I am.
because we don't swing through trees and eat bananas anymore.
That's close. Very
okay,
close.
Cool.
Bananas?
I was just being silly and I got it right.
There you go.
That was my entire degree.
No guesses. I'm looking at very blank faces, so I'm just going to move right along with that. Basically, what they've come to speculate on is that we came to use fire. One day, a smart chimp was there with a stick and rubbing them two together made fire. And it was the fact that this fire changed the way we ate our food. So that's where the bananas came
from. Are they saying that monkeys discovered fire and not humans?
No, I said that.
Okay. No, I have a feeling it was probably some common ancestor back there who discovered the fire, or after we split, and our branch then went, hey, fire, pick that up and run with it. That's
and
a good thing.
And started cooking all their food, and mm-hmm. so what was needed was different biochemical processes break down and absorb different toxins.
Isn't that clever? So the fact that we started eating differently because we're cooking the food means that even though we've got a lot of the same stuff in our genetic code, we're different from the chimps and the bonobos and the orangutans. Right. And it's all because we cook stuff.
Right.
Nice.
Right.
So does that mean that vegetarians will regress back to monkey form?
Only if they're eating raw vegetables.
Only fruitarians.
Right. Yes.
Maybe you should bring that up with the researchers from the University of Chicago and tell them to do another study.
Exactly. Go and look at the livers of non-fire using vegetarians and
there's
see what
happens. There's a PhD project in that.
I think there is.
There's a PhD project in a lot of things.
So how close are we to our cousins? I mean, if it's all about genes and all about gene expression and regulation, just how close are we?
Well, I think just how close we are is actually an incredibly hard question to answer, because I'm not sure if you guys remember, but a couple of years ago, there was a group of geneticists who compared 97 genes from humans and chimps. So 97 genes, this is 90,000 base pairs. It's not a small number.
This is a sizable chunk of DNA.
And they discovered that there was a 99.4% sequence identity. So this is where, I'm not sure if you do remember, but there was a whole big thing about should humans and chimpanzees actually be part of the same genus? Were that similar? And of course, this was a bit of an uproar because, how do you now change from the normal biological classification of looking at physical, physiological, and behavioural traits to suddenly comparing genomes instead and how similar your base?
But also, where do you draw the line? Is it 99.4? 99.3? Is it 80%?
I mean, humans and bananas share about 50% of their DNA.
That's right.
So where do you draw the line? We're all just bloody banana people. I don't know.
Are we? Speak for yourself, Christopher.
Well, you go to that point, you know.
But I mean, I think it's definitely interesting that it's gene expression rather than the raw number of genes that's what's making us different. You're listening to Diffusion, a very evolved radio program. And finally, here are some short science stories. Another useless use of the internet for the week. Matthew Clark.
Yes, the boffins at MIT in Boston, instead of looking for the cure for cancer, they've actually developed wine glasses that are Wi-Fi capable.
Hang on, Wi-Fi, that's like wireless internet.
That's right. So they have incorporated wireless internet devices into wine glasses.
Because
what they want to do is they want people to be able to drink together over the internet.
Ooh.
Right. There's more to this. There's got to be more. Why?
Not
why?
Much.
Why would you?
Not much more. What these glasses do is you can hold. Let's say, I suppose to their credit, one possible use could be that. Let's say you're working abroad, and you got a wife in Australia, and you're working in Boston. And you want to have a drink with your wife, the closest thing you can come to it is using these Wi-Fi wine glasses.
Okay. So, I'm your wife, mm-hmm. right? I'm in Australia. You're mm-hmm. in Boston. I've got a wine glass.
Mm-hmm. I'm wearing the pants, by the way.
Okay. What happens?
Well, you both, when you raise your glass, a little light comes on the other person's glass that tells them that you are raising the glass.
Aww. Isn't that nice?
And then it gets better. Once
oh, there's more.
There is more. Once you actually start drinking, another light comes on so that you can tell when the other person's lips are actually touching the glass, so you can pretend that you're actually there.
And so you can run your tongue over the glass.
Yes, you can do
it. Okay, and moving right along.
There are other internet-enabled devices that are maybe not so child-friendly.
But, I mean, seriously, like, does this happen a lot? Like, how many people are going to buy these?
Yeah, so you've got to pack these and take them with you when you're travelling.
Don't forget your wine glass, dear.
Oh,
yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Hang on, you weren't there when we said we went, I forgot to turn my glass on.
Yeah.
The batteries ran out.
Does it say whether it's connected by wires or anything? Like how drinking friendly?
So
wireless, sorry.
Yeah, so come on.
So it's pretty drink friendly then. So it's not like you're tangling anything.
And it's also...
doesn't seem right. It's also doesn't seem...
Yeah.
As well as Wi-Fi, it's also GPRS enabled, so you can
Via
a mobile. So you don't even need to
goodness.
Be near
well, if that isn't Wi-Fi. If that isn't the most fascinating thing to come out of the internet. What about Tilly? I heard you had something about coffee. Is it going to be good for me, my early morning caffeine fix?
Well, that all depends. It's mostly, I think, bad news for coffee drinkers. Some scientific researchers at the University of Toronto in Canada have recently linked coffee with an increased risk of heart attacks.
Say it isn't so.
Yeah, allegedly, people carrying a common variation in a certain gene could be increasing their risk of heart attack by drinking several cups of coffee a day.
Now, I think Starbucks needs to get one of these little blood testers in at the start so I know that I'm safe when I'm drinking.
Yeah, I don't want to mess around with this.
Well, there have been studies like this in the past that have been met with some controversy because apparently coffee addicts are more likely to have other bad habits like smoking and other unspecified unhealthy behaviour, would you believe?
That kind of unhealthy behaviour.
The unspecified
exactly.
So what you're saying here then is that if you do have this particular genetic disposition, you might also be the kind of person who has other bad habits, and we need to know that so that we can stop you taking up hospital beds.
Exactly. Well, that's what they're trying to throw out there. In this new study, though, the research tested whether the gene CYP1A2 promoted heart disease. Absolutely catchy title. Apparently there is two different versions of this gene. because it codes for an enzyme which helps break down caffeine, and it can either code for an enzyme that does it, that metabolizes it fast, or metabolizes it slowly.
Right.
And apparently the people who metabolize it slowly are increasing their risk of heart disease if they start drinking 3 or more cups of coffee a day.
So the trouble is, you don't know unless you actually go and have the test. Have a coffee on the way to the hospital and see how it all turns out.
Exactly.
Or just keep your coffee consumption to less than 3 cups a day.
Not possible, I'm afraid. Not possible for me.
All the good advice here at Diffusion. That's all from us in this edition of Diffusion. If you'd like to contact us, you can reach us via email at diffusion@2ser.com. Again, that's diffusion@2ser.com. Contributing to the program this week were Matthew Clark, Chris Stewart and Tilly Berlin. Diffusion has been produced by Chris Stewart in the studios of 2SER Sydney. Diffusion is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. I'm Jackie Hayes. Join us next week for more science on Diffusion.